My name is Keith Lamar. Most of my friends call me Bomani Shakur. Bomani Shakur is an African attribute I adopted back in 1993, or shortly after 1993, when or after I got caught up in the aftermath of the Lucasville riot. I've been in prison for 26 years now. I've been in solitary confinement for 22 years and on death row for 20 years. And I arrived on death row as a result of the Lucasville prison riot at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville, Ohio. I came to prison for murder because of my crimes. I was sentenced to a maximum security prison, Southern Ohio Correctional Facility, as I just mentioned. And
this call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
The Southern Ohio Correctional Facility was perhaps one of the most dangerous prisons in Ohio at the time in the early 90s. In fact, before I arrived there in 1991, a school teacher by the name of Beverly Taylor was viciously murdered by a black prisoner in 1990. And this led to a new warden being appointed at the prison at the time. His name was Arthur Taylor. Some people came to know him as King Arthur because of his strict adherence to rules and whatnot. And by the time I arrived in 1991, his regime was in full effect. You know, it was pretty draconian how he would, you know, chose to run the prison. You know, lines were painted on the floor. Guys were directed to keep their shirts tucked in, and, you know, cells and work assignments were being, you know, traded, you know, based on how much information you was willing to provide the administration with. And so it was a real oppressive, repressive place. You know, snitches came to really rule the day. And on April 1993, the Muslims, after being denied an alternative way by which to take a tuberculosis test, decided to stage what they said or thought would be a peaceful protest. You know, they commandeered the keys from the guards and used them to open the cells in the various blocks on the L side portion of the prison, you know, letting guys out of their cells. And as I said, you know, from 1990, resulting from the school teacher's death leading up to that time, you know, everybody was living under a lot of strain, a lot of pent-up animosity directed at the administration. So when the Muslims took over the pod and let guys out of their cell, they unbeknownstly unleashed a torrent of unbridled aggression. And, you know, almost immediately, guys who saw what was going on and decided not to be a part of the riot filed out onto the yard, the prison yard, recreation yard. You know, I was among those 400 or so inmates who decided not to participate because, you know, it was clearly a altercation between Sunni Muslims and the warden, at least initially it was.
Sure.
So I came out into the yard and things unfolded from there, you know. You know, not long after I came out on the yard, or the Ohio Highway State Patrol showed up along with the National Guard, in which we all assumed they would, you know, storm the building, restore order, and whatnot. But instead, they took up position around the perimeter fence and watched as things unfolded. It didn't take long for dead bodies, you know, to appear on the yard. You know, one after another, you know, dead bodies were brought out of the building. And this is only disturbance or the uprising, and were unceremoniously dumped on the yard, and the Highway State Patrol and National Guard stood back and watched as these bodies were brought out of the building.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, along with the other guys who were out on the yard, you know, I came to believe, you know, based on what I was seeing, that, you know, one of those dead bodies could have easily been mine. And, you know, this spirit, you know, reverberated around the whole yard, and it became, you know, very tense, very, you know, life-threatening, you know, to be out in the middle of the yard exposed. But it was either that or enter the building into untold dangers. And so, you know, I stayed out on the yard, and around 4 o'clock in the morning, the Ohio Highway State Patrol decided to come out to the yard and rescue us, so to speak. And with that
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
You know, they came out with their guns pointed at our heads and, you know, barked out orders for us to file into the K-side gymnasium, the opposite side of the prison. And there about, you know, 400 or so prisoners were stripped naked, thrown into the middle of the floor like cattle, and then selected random groups of 10 and placed in a single man cell. And that's really where my situation started. You know, a guy was named Dennis Weaver was ultimately killed in this cell that I was placed in. And after the guards came to retrieve us from the cell to find out what had happened, they tried to get us to, you know, inform on each other. You know, I, you know, after seeing what, you know, what happened to snitches, as I said, their bodies were already being brought on the yard and brought out onto the yard, dumped on the yard. And so, you know, I refused to, you know, to talk. And which gave the actual perpetrators of the crime the opportunity to kind of shift the blame. They admitted to killing this guy, Dennis Weaver, but said that I, along with another inmate, forced him to do it. And in their mind was a way for them to lessen their culpability, you know, even though it was a lie, you know, and this story kind of took on, you know, and after the riot came to an end, after 11 days, an investigation period started, you know, and I, you know, joined other guys who were dissatisfied with the way in which we had been treated. We started protesting, you know, throwing our food on the range, garbage on the range, and also imploring guys not to become informants, encouraging them not to help the administration. And, you know, I was one of the main, you know, one of the most outspoken, you know, voices at the time, you know, trying to encourage guys not to become informants and also participating in the demonstration because, you know, I was very upset having been literally left for dead and then treated like an animal after the fact. You know, I was upset, you know, and so I took a stance against, you know, the administration and unbeknownstly made myself a target. You know, the riot, after it began, three groups, the Sunni Muslims, the Aryan Brotherhood, and a gang called the Black Gangster Disciples, ultimately assumed authority positions and presided over the riot for the 11 days that it lasted. When it was all over said and done, 9 prisoners and 1 officer were killed. And, you know, they, you know, understandably wanted to find out who was responsible for the guards' death and hold those individuals responsible. And so in order to do this, you know, they allowed the leaders of the Black Gangster Disciples to become state witnesses and thereby, you know, kind of shirk their responsibility because it was thought by many that the Black Gangster Disciples was responsible for the majority of the deaths of the prisoners. And so by becoming state witnesses and making themselves available to testify against the leaders of the Sunni Muslims and Aryan Brotherhood, they was able to shirk their responsibility. And but still, when all was said and done, they still had the inmate murders to contend with, and they charged me with those murders. Said I was the leader of this group, even though it was established that I had never been in the gang. That I came out onto the yard on the first day. They said you know, they said that I was the leader of the death squad, they dubbed it, and said...
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
You know, that I forced prisoners, you know, who were considered snitches to be killed. You know, but they only charged me with this crime because I was already doing a life sentence with the possibility of parole, albeit. And they thought that because I was serving a life sentence, that I would capitulate and, you know, accept a deal, you know, but, you know, I, you know, pleaded innocent, you know, told them that I didn't have anything to do with it. How can I have anything to do with it when I was on the yard? I, you know, pleaded with them to see reason, you know, but, you know, they wanted to put me on the hook for these things, you know, to clean up their books, you know, and, you know, looking back, I probably, you know, some people think I should have taken the deal. I would have spared myself the death penalty, of course, by doing that, but, you know, I was innocent. I am innocent. And so I, you know, demanded a trial. And, you know, you know, by the demand in the trial, they was very upset by that, and their way, you know, to respond to my audacity was to withhold any evidence that was favorable to my defense. It took me close to 20 years after I had already been convicted and sentenced to death to discover some of the evidence that they had withheld, you know, and come to find out it was evidence from members of the Black Ancient Disciples, one of the gangs who was said to have, you know, killed most of the prisoners. One of the members from the Black Ancient Disciples came forward and committed killing someone for whom I was ultimately sentencing, you know, convicted and sentenced to death. So, you know, I just been, you know, trying to piece the story together and put it in a form.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Put it in a form that's understandable to people, just regular people, you know, because I'm, you know, my point or purpose or goal is to retry my case in the court of public opinion. So I wrote a book called Condemned, which, you know, discusses everything I laid out in fine detail, you know, in hopes that people would read the story, get involved, because it's not really just about my story, as it turns out, but a systemic problem dealing with the treatment of poor people in this country. You know, my case is a case study on what happens when you're poor. It doesn't really matter whether or not you're innocent or guilty. What matters is whether or not you have the money to represent yourself. And I think Brian Stevens, famous lawyer out of Alabama, recently said that it's a rich, guilty person is treated better than a poor, innocent person in this country, in which is to say that, you know, justice itself has been it's nothing but a commodity.
Thank you for using Global Tellink.
Hello?
Hello?
Okay, yeah, hey, Brett. I'm sorry about that, man. I couldn't hear you at all, yeah.
All right, so we're good now?
We're good now, yeah.
Were you in the middle? I can ask more questions. You want to finish what you were saying earlier?
Well, that, in a nutshell, is how I came to be where I am and what I'm doing to try to save myself from being executed. I wrote a book called Condemned, and it explains in, you know, fine detail all the stuff, you know, elaborate on some of the stuff that I'm talking about. Obviously, it's too long to go through the whole thing over the phone, but that, you know, in a nutshell is, you know, how I came to be where I am and what I'm trying to do to remedy the situation. So, yeah, you can fire away, man, whatever you want to ask.
Some ways that people talk about political prisoners, I think, sort of only count people who were engaged in political activity on the outside and got arrested. But then,
yeah,
obviously, like, it's also important to include people, right, engaged in political activity on the inside and engaged in struggles happening in prisons. I would love to hear your thoughts about, like, the label of a political prisoner, what that means to you, what it doesn't mean, and how, like, I don't know, that relationship, right?
I mean, it's an interesting question. You know, people make the distinction and, you know, divide it. That's how they rule us. By they, I mean those in power. You know, obviously, you know, prisoners, you know, high-profile prisoners like Mami Abu-Jamal, obviously, who were, you know, part of the Panthers and part of the MOVE organization when he was on the streets, and perhaps even his affiliation in those groups led to him being, you know, railroaded in the way that he did. But, you know, I don't think anyone would dispute the fact that he qualifies a political prisoner. You know, but I came to prison by a totally different route. You know, I was a drug dealer. You know, I was selling drugs in the ghetto in Cleveland, Ohio, in one of the most drug-infested, crime-ridden areas in that city. You know, I came there when I was 15 years old, you know, after being kicked out of my house by my father, which is a separate story. But, you know, the part that relates to other people who are, you know, in prison, because you have over 2.3 million people in prison. Predominantly, those crimes, you know, stem from the so-called war on drugs. You know, those numbers stem from the so-called war on drugs, and that's a political thing. You know, one of the things, you know, even if you're ignorant, you know, doesn't necessarily take the weight that's what's being done to you with political. You know, when the so-called war on drugs was, you know, initially waged, there was another war going on in Nicaragua. You know, the Sandinistas had overrun the country, and the people who, you know, fled to the United States, the Contras, or the people who would have ultimately become the Contras, needed funds to fight that war, that civil war that was going on in Nicaragua. And, you know, the United States couldn't get it back, and I'm sure you know the story. to finance the war. So they allow these people to sell cocaine, to dump this cocaine that eventually, you know, I had in my hands. You know, they allowed that cocaine to come in, and that was a political.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
You know, we live in a system where the weapon is 1% on close to 50% of all the wealth and resources, and that's based on the political policies that are in, and practices that are in place. And because of these unjust economic situation, you have, you know, poverty, abject poverty, with, you know, which necessitates crime, which brings about the type of thing. So that's also political. So, you know, my thought about the whole thing, what constitutes a political prisoners, and anybody who live under the system of capitalism and find themselves in prison, for the most part. Of course, you have people here who, you know, rape children or have some kind of other mental aberration that, you know, leads them to, you know, do these, you know, incredibly horrible things. But for the most part, you know, guys are in prison because of poverty, because they was hungry or betrayed. They was in some, you know, sense of, you know, in some sense pursuing the so-called American dream. You know, all this is, you know, to me, is political. You know, I think C. Wright Mills in his book, the sociological imagination speaks pretty, you know, vividly on what constitutes a political agent, you know, in society. And it doesn't really matter whether or not you are aware, you know, of what's being done to you. You know, those who are doing it to you, they are aware, and that, you know, constitutes the primary problem that we have. You know, as far as, you know, people working together across these lines, I think, you know, your question kind of, you know, points to, you know, some of the stuff that we have to overcome, these, you know, false labels, you know, as if, you know, somehow, since you are aware of the fact that you're being fucked over, somehow makes you better than the person who is not aware. You know, we're all in the same boat. You know, some of us know it, some of us don't. And the job of those of us who know, you know, what's going on is to educate those who don't know. Each one reach one. So, you know, that's the mentality that I have and, you know, how I, you know, try to approach, you know, the whole, you know, political and non-political dichotomy. Yeah.
One thing, right, that people always talk about with the Lucasville uprising is the way that in those moments for those 11 days, a lot of kind of racial barriers were broken. I'm sure you have a lot of other experiences being incarcerated. They could also speak to those divisions and times they've been overcome. If there's anything you want to say about that?
Well, you know, in society, it's easy to keep people separated in the barrios, favelas, ghettos, or whatever the case may be. You know, all poor people all have the same common enemy, but they separated and kept separated by these different manufactured prejudices and hates and whatnot. You know, but when you come to prison, you know, most of those barriers are removed. There's no, you know, Chinatown, no, you know, barrio in here. It's just cell blocks. And, you know, the guards, you know, for the most part, who are white, you know, they inflict the same, you know, pain on everybody. You know, everybody got it coming in here. And so after a while, unless you're totally blind or totally, you know, stupid, you know, because ignorance can be cured, and nothing cures ignorance like experience. You know, seeing things with your own eyes. You know, Jason Robb, who, you know, was purported to be one of the leaders of the Aryan Brotherhood, you know, has been, you know, one of my closest friends for the past, you know, two decades. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, scratch their head when I say that, but, you know, he and I have, you know, helped each other, you know, through this, you know, very trying situation we've been in, because we've been forced, you know, pretty much, you know, into each other's lives. You know, we sail next to each other for quite a bit of this 20 years. And, you know, in one particular instance, you know, Jason Robb, you know, received, and I talk about this in my book, Condemned, you know, how the guards came in and attacked him, jumped on him, and, you know, bust his skull, you know, after which he, you know, required like 30-something stitches to his head. And so these was white people who did this to him. And, you know, when he went through his trial, it was white people who got on the stand and lied on him. And in my case, it was black people who got on the stand and lied on me. So we began to, you know, individually, then collectively see that, you know, that our divisions were basically superficial. And that the same thing that was being done to me was being done to him and being done by the same people. And so we, you know, started to overcome our differences to align ourselves against these people. you know, like out in society, have white, black, and, you know, Puerto Rican, this, that, rich, poor, middle, this, you know what I mean? But really, it's just the wealthiest 1% creating these divisions.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
And feeding, you know, feeding us misinformation that keep us separated and confused about who our real enemies are. You know, and you know, that's one of the things I think people need to, you know, come to understand and comprehend about this system. You know, divided, you know, that's how they rule. You know, and, but it only takes, you know, people from different walks of life come together like, you know, we're doing right now to, you know, speak to, you know, give the truth to that lie, you know, to show them that, you know, not all of us are asleep. And, you know, with respect to the American dream, you know, it's a dream, you know, and all of us, you know, dream when we go to sleep at night. And then we wake up and we live our real life. And see, that's the thing that, you know, we have to, you know, get to, you know, have to, you know, get out of the dream state and wake up to reality and start, you know, negotiating these obstacles in front of us. And you know, it's something that I see being done, you know, with the Black Lives Matter. A lot of black, white people are included in that struggle. And that's the kind of thing that really needs to happen. Hopefully that movement would evolve beyond Black Lives Matter to All Lives Matter. And that's the point that we really have to get to. I understand the emphasis, at least, you know, with respect, you know, given, you know, the recent, you know, or the rash of killings of these innocent black men in the street. So I understand the instinct to, you know, make that announcement. But ultimately, if the movement is going to pick up the necessary momentum that it needs to make the kind of change that this society requires, you know, people have to evolve beyond that, you know, black lives or white lives or whatever lives. It's all lives matter. We all human beings. And, you know, that's the, one of the things that we have to grasp, you know. I mean, you know, education is the key, you know, and, you know, awareness is the key, obviously. You know, people need to know the statistics, you know. You know, a lot of the rage that, you know, stem from these recent or these rash of killings, you know, stem from people, you know, believing, you know, that this is a new thing, that this is a new phenomenon. And for a lot of people it is, you know, but, you know, for anybody who has read a history book, you know, they've been killing black men since the inception of this country, since the first black man was brought to this country. You know, they was hanging black men with impunity, killing black men with impunity, you know, since, you know, black men been in this country. It's nothing new. You know, and these struggles, these protests that you see, they also aren't new. You know, Michelle Alexander recently wrote a book called The New Jim Crow. Well, during the old Jim Crow, you know, black men was routinely lynched in the South, you know, for no justification, no reason, similar to how Mike Brown, but we live in the 21st century. So, you know, one of the first things that needs to happen is, you know, we need to, you know, stage some teach-ins, you know, where people learn this history. You know, and just like you see white people involved in the Black Lives Movement, you had white people involved in...
You have 1 minute remaining.
You know, John Brown was white, you know, and he gave his life up to help, you know, free slaves. And, you know, and so you have, you know, people, individual people becoming aware, becoming educated and, you know, being, you know, becoming heroic. And so that's what we need, you know, each of us. First, we need to become educated to the history, you know, because it's just history repeating itself in a different guise. You know, a lot of people don't, since they don't know the history, they don't, you know, recognize that this is, you know, something that has already been endured and conquered. We've already won this battle. But since we don't know our history, we keep fighting the same battle over and over again. So in a very real sense, we're on a treadmill, you see. And those in power make us believe that we haven't progressed, but we really haven't went anywhere, you know. And so, you know, that's the sense that people have to, you know, get to understand what has already been accomplished. So we don't have to win the same or fight the same battles over and over again. We pick off where the last...
Right, so we have to learn the history.
Oh, wait.
Wait, 1 second. Yeah.
Hello? Okay, wait. The CEOs are coming through, I think.
Yeah, that's right. You're in prison with me, huh? It's something else, huh? We've been doing it so much, you kind of know what's going on, huh? Is it okay now?
It seems good.
Hello?
Yeah, you're good.
Okay, yeah. I was just basically saying that, you know, we need to learn the history, just a basic fundamental understanding of this history, you know, this resistance movement, you know, we need to, tell people about all these heroes, you know, all these different and various people who are doing or were engaged in the same struggles that we are right now engaged in now, because capitalism, you know, creates these struggles, these vast discrepancies between the rich and the poor, and it has...
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
Has always been the case. You know, crashes, recessions, all that, you know, poverty, you know, oppression, all these things are built into the system of capitalism. You know, so people need to understand that, and so they can understand the natural outcome of this thing. You know, it has to be overcome. The system has to be overcome. You know, I just recently read a book by Naomi Klein, which, you know, on the surface may seem totally separated from the struggle that, or this movement that we're trying to cultivate. But she wrote a book called This Changes Everything, talking about, you know, climate change and global warming. And, you know, these, problems, again, is a result of capitalism. You know, the burning of fossil fuels was really the foundation of capitalism. You know, but fossil fuels, as everybody knows, you know, is changing the temperature of the planet. And, you know, if we don't get our shit together, you know, according to Naomi Klein, then, you know, we're all going, you know, we're all headed for trouble. But Richard Wright, who's one of my, you know, favorite authors, said that, you know, if United States, if this country can't find its way to a human path, you know, if it can't inform action with a deep sense of life, then all of us, black as well as white, are going down the same drain. You know, it's not like, you know, when this planet, you know, is no longer sustainable or no longer strong enough to sustain life. It's not just black people who are going to die. You know, white people, brown people, everything. And so, you know, we have to, you know, cultivate this understanding, you know, of how deep our connection really is and how equal our responsibility is as human beings to get involved in this whole thing. Because, you know, the wealth is 1%, they're so deluded or so blinded by their greed and by their wealth and their power that they, you know, believe that they are going to be able to build another colony in another, on another, you know, outer space somewhere. And they're right now exploring those options. Who knows, maybe they have a place where, you know, a certain, you know, amount of people can live, you know, in another galaxy, you know. But, you know, why even, you know, take that leap or let them put us in that type of situation? But, you know, that's where we're headed. If, you know, what, you know, people like Naomi Klein is what they're saying is true, you know, and I believe it is, yeah. So, you know, people just have to, you know, become aware of the fundamental connection that we share as human beings and, you know, not be afraid to, you know, step across those boundaries, step across those lines, to reach inside these prison cells, to reach inside the ghetto, you know, and vice versa. You know, so, you know, I talk to college students, you know, regularly, and, you know, these, you know, young people are from different socioeconomic backgrounds and whatnot, but I'm reaching across those, you know, boundaries in order to make a connection, in order to, you know, because, you know, according to those in power, you know, I'm in prison because, you know, I'm morally defective, because I'm, you know, ignorant and stupid, you know, because I'm, you know, 3/5 of a human being. You know, all these, you know, lies that they tell people, you know, because there's no one there to refute it. Well, I'm trying to refute that, you know, and I'm not in prison because I'm stupid. I'm in prison because I'm poor. You know, and people need to understand that, you know. And, you know, so that's, you know, the point, you know, the reason why I'm calling in, you know, just to let people know that you have people in here who are trying to, you know, arm themselves for this, you know, coming fight, you know. And it's coming, you know, we're in the stage, beginning stages of it, you know, and it could spark if just enough people, you know, wake up, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing that I'm doing is, like I said, it's not really just prisoner support. It's just support across the board. Mm-hmm. you know, the things that I'm doing in addition to fighting for my own life, you know, I started a nonprofit, Native Sons, which is a literacy program. Get books into access, you know, to guys, people who are in the detention home and whatnot, because it's really book education, you know, that's really, you know, saved my sanity. You know,
hey,
I'm on death row and of course, yeah.
Say that again because you cut out again and that's important.
Say what again?
What you're saying right now, they're coming through again. It's walkie-talkie time, you know?
About getting books into these young people.
It's still done.
Okay. Just have to probably wait until they pass through.
There you go. Now it's good.
Yeah, it might jump in and out. But Brad, I'm just, you know, trying to, you know, it's not really about me sitting back waiting on people to reach across and support me. You know, just all of us need to drop our you know, rakes or plows where we are and start moving. You know, one of the things I'm doing, I'm trying to get books into at-risk youth so they can, you know, begin to grow and broaden their scope and hopefully, you know, become more aware of the part that they're playing in their own self-destruction. You know, support the need for prisoners.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
You know, support to me for prisoners is books then, you know, education, you know, and, you know, that's one of the things that I'm, you know, as an individual will be trying to do in the coming days and months is trying to, you know, set up a situation where I can get these books into these young people who wouldn't otherwise be exposed to, you know, certain knowledge, you know. And so, you know, that's the thing, you know, support to me, the prison, you know, I'm on death row. And, you know, it's very expensive, man. We've been exploited in here. So it's very expensive to make calls. It's very expensive to get copies made. It's very expensive to, you know, try to, you know, because the book that I wrote, Condemned, I couldn't write that and send it out through the regular mail because it would have never made it. And so after I wrote each page and get a nice, you know, a group of pages, I would have to, you know, talk over the phone, transcribe those pages over the phone to one of my friends who would then type it into a computer. If you can imagine, that was a very expensive endeavor. You know, mm-hmm. you know, especially, you know, living in this type of situation. And so, you know, just, you know, help in any way that you can. You know, some people, you know, obviously, you know, have busy lives and don't, you know, have the time, you know, to take, you know, away from their own lives. And so get what you can. Do what you can. You know, each one, you know, do what they can, you know, and try to set it up where it's reciprocal. You know, with the people that you are helping, you know, they say if you, you know, give a man a fish, you know, he'll starve, but if you teach him how to fish, he can live for the rest of his life. I'm paraphrasing, you know, and so that's the thing, you know, try to teach people how to become, you know, productive citizens
right.
By being the productive citizen, you know. Yeah. By showing, you know, teach people how to, you know, respond, you know, be human by, you know, expressing your humanity, by doing for them or for us, what you would want done for you if the situations were, you know, reversed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's all I have. Is there anything you would like to say?
No, that's it, man. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to, you know, lend my fuel to this fire, you know, and so that's the thing that I'm trying to do. Hopefully, you know, those in power can no longer tell, you know, the lie that, you know, everybody in these places are ignorant and naive and don't understand, you know, what life, you know, means, what it's worth,
right.
You know, because, you know, obviously that's some bullshit. And so, you know, I encourage you guys to continue to do, you know, do what you are doing. You know, it's very important work. It's very, you know, significant, you know, especially at this day and time. And so, you know, thanks for having me. And, you know, I wish y'all all the best, man. Yeah.
Thank you.